Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. We have a rerun of an interview with the CCPA on poverty in Canada on the day Dalton McGuinty introduces the new budget. We do, however, have new reviews of articles in the paper and a new segment of the show, so stay tuned.
Disrespect introduces Seth Klein, the BC Director for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jeff.
We were going to talk to you about the study that you've done. Ontario, with a big flurry of interest in defining poverty, hasn't done a similar study yet, but they're promising to come up with definitions by the end of the year. I'd be very interested to know what your study found out. You followed BC fixed income recipients for 2 years. Did that include people with a disability? It says expected to return to work income recipients.
Well, back in 2002, the BC government brought in a whole host of changes to welfare policy.
Particularly
targeted those who they determined were in the expected-to-work category. And so that group, we figured, would feel the brunt of all of those policy changes.
All right.
But we were particularly interested in people who were in that category, but we suspected didn't belong there. And so it was 62 people that we recruited back in 2004 for the study. They all had to be in the expected to work category, and they all had to have been on social assistance for at least 15 months, although on average they had been on there on and off for 8 years. And as the study evolved, many of them did ultimately get disability status.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, we can talk about that, because that was actually one of the key findings out of the study, is how that whole process worked. I should say that Ontario has done, there are social policy people in Ontario who've done this kind of long-term tracking work in Ontario.
When?
I know there was a group that did it, I think it was out of through the Caledon Institute back in the Harris era.
Oh, yeah.
And followed, it was a bit different, because they were following families in particular.
Yeah.
And people with families with children, I believe. Whereas ours had some people with kids in our study, but we structured our project a little differently.
How did you handle the people who were accepted into disability halfway through your study?
Well, that was fine. That was one of the things that we actually thought might well happen. So maybe I should just take a step back and tell you what, big picture, what happened to the people over the 2 years.
Yeah. I have a list here, a press release with a list of seven key findings.
Oh, okay. Do you want to focus on one of them, or do you want me to tell you what where they were at the end?
I think we'll go through them from your point of view,
right?
Because you were one of the people who authored the study, and if we find something of special interest, we'll expand on it.
All right.
And it also doesn't really work to take one result out of context. I don't think.
So at the end of the 2 years, we completed interviews with 45 of the 62 people. Which is a pretty good retention rate for a study like this.
Lost,
it was a very transient population. And
what happened to the other 17?
Well, we know a fair amount about them, and there's a page in the study that details what we do know about them.
Okay.
One of them died. A few of them found employment, but many of them were homeless. We figured that of the 17, 4 to 6 of them were arguably somewhat better off.
Right.
The others, most of the others, we just don't know by the end. Of the 45 who did stay with the study throughout, about 2/3 of them remained on social assistance at the end of the study, although a few of those had temporarily left and then gone back on. A quarter of them had left voluntarily, almost all for employment, and four of them were kicked off welfare, involuntary leavers, if you will.
Right.
Although if you include some of the people who had temporarily left, in the course of our study, seven people out of 62 were kicked off welfare for various durations.
So,
and their experience deserves special attention. But
so
on your
three of them were out of that group of 17, is what I hear then?
No, three out of the... So four of them were kicked off welfare as of the last interview.
Right.
Three of them had temporarily left welfare, but not our study. And
oh.
were back on welfare by the end of the study.
Okay.
Of the 2/3 who were on social assistance at the end of the study, 2/3 of them had been upgraded, if you will. They had disability status now or some other recognized barrier to employment. And here, there's a good news, bad news story. The good news is they have a little bit more income from social assistance. They are excused from jumping through all these employment hoops that are fundamentally inappropriate to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused people a great deal of stress.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy is that it took so long. As I said, most of the, on average, the people in our study had been on social assistance 8 years when the study started. And we could tell from the very first interviews, because we asked lots of questions about their health status, that many of them, while they were officially in the expected to work category, didn't belong there.
Yeah.
And it took the system years to recognize that reality for some people when it should have been obvious way earlier.
Yeah, when you say it should have been obvious, then the implication is that some of the administrators of the system, whatever their status as administrators or clerks, or they probably knew.
Yeah, I think the system as a whole, for many of them, knew and was just content to have them languish in the expected to work category. One of the findings that comes out, and I think this is true in Ontario as well from other research there that I've seen, is just how important it becomes to people to connect with an advocate. Someone at the community level, maybe they're based with a nonprofit, maybe they're based out of a church, but an advocate who knows all the intricacies of the rules, who will help them navigate the application process for assistance or for disability status. And so very often, it takes making that kind of a connection.
What range of people would you class as potential advocates?
Some of them are based within churches. Some of them are based with different community groups. Out here in BC, you know, there's even an email list, listserv of them. And some of them are just people around the province who have been there themselves and do this on their own time. And some of them are based at women's centers. But they're people who give each other advice and who know the ins and outs of the rules.
Yeah, worthwhile. I think we have a sort of informal collection of such people here. There's nothing official. But, I mean, as you say, they're in various social agencies and probably women's centers. I don't access women's centers. How can you tell? And there are people who've been through the system who will advocate if people seek them out as well.
One of the important findings about the disability, those who got disability, is while it's great that they got disability, they continue to experience tremendous hardship.
So the extra amount of money wasn't enough for someone with a disability?
No, I mean, it's more, but only because the basic benefit levels are so low.
It's the same here. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, and the rates aren't all that different between our two provinces.
Really?
We ask hardship questions at the beginning of the study and throughout, like about their housing security, their food security. One of the interesting findings is at the beginning of the study, the group as a whole were using food banks or soup kitchens 11 times a month on average.
Wow.
Then at the end of the study...
So doing the rounds of almost all the soup, the food banks.
Yeah, for some it's a core way in which people meet their food needs.
Right.
And then at the end of the study, when you look at this group of people who've been upgraded to disability status, they see an improvement for sure. Mm-hmm. But they're still using food banks or soup kitchens four times a month. And yet, this is supposed to be the good news story, right?
Yeah, right.
That people
yeah.
now have been appropriately categorized.
Yeah.
And yet, this is to be as good as it gets.
Yeah.
And what emerges is really a reality that we all kind of know, but I think it's sometimes helpful to put it in these terms,
right.
Which is, you know, everyone likes to gripe about welfare.
Yep.
But ultimately, most Canadians are glad that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that there should be some bottom rung of the social safety net that's there when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does it mean when we have a social safety net, a public welfare system,
mm-hmm.
that is structurally dependent on food banks and other charities to meet basic food needs?
It's a good question.
And I don't think, when it's put that way, I don't think that's actually what most Canadians have in mind.
That's funny, because it's what most Canadians have provided. But I tend to agree with you. I don't think people expect that if you're provided with the money to live, that involves a good portion of literal charity.
One of the things that gives me hope in this stuff is when you talk to the public about welfare stuff, you're often confronting myths that people have.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to think welfare is more generous than it is.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's easier to get than it is.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's easier to stay on than it is.
Mm-hmm.
But when presented with the facts, it often does not sit well with people.
Oh, really?
I'll give you an example out of some polling work that we've done. And
mm-hmm.
this is BC numbers, but I think it would be similar in Ontario. But if you just cold polled people in the public about whether or not welfare rates should be increased.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically 50-50 down the middle, yes.
Oh, really?
But if you simply preface the question by telling people what rates are, how much you actually get on
welfare.
You
mean just a dollar amount?
Just the dollar amount. And then ask the question, 75% of them say increase it.
And yet the truth is, too, I think that most people have a hard time connecting the dollar amount with means of surviving.
It's not
real to someone who makes $60,000 a year. That amount just has no significance. They might connect it with a budget item of theirs, car payments or something. But other than that, I don't think they have any idea.
Maybe, although what those poll numbers tell me is that when people hear those dollar amounts in high numbers, they instantly recognize that you can't actually make ends meet.
It's interesting. What it tells me is that it tells me a little bit more. If it's true that they don't really understand, most of them don't really understand what those numbers mean, except maybe to some of them they look a little low. If they really understood what those numbers meant, your 75% might go up further.
Yeah. Well, and that was one of our goals with this study. The study and a lot of the study's had quite a lot of media pickup in British Columbia, I should say, since we released it a couple weeks ago. And part of our objective with all of that was to really drive home just what it means to try to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
And the degree to which, well, first of all, at any given time in our study, a third of the people report being homeless at some point in the previous 6 months,
mm-hmm.
which really drives home just how hard it is to find housing on a welfare check.
Did you get any idea of the public tolerance for homelessness?
Well, out here, particularly... You know, given the rising numbers, and they are,
mm-hmm.
and given the impending Olympics, this is a big issue out here.
Oh, yeah, I never thought of that.
And so it's a very big issue here. And so our challenge, one of the things we did, I think, with the report is connect some dots for people between
mm-hmm.
welfare policy
mm-hmm.
and what they see on the streets in front of them.
Oh, right.
Everyone sees it. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's distressed by it. But they don't always connect it back to welfare policy.
Your tax dollars at work or not.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. And you got a lot of newspaper exposure.
Yeah, all media exposure.
We were talking about the welfare rates and people's recognition that they need to be improved. And you remarked that they're not too different from Ontario. Do you know what the fixed income rate is in BC for welfare and disability? I understand you used to have two levels of disability entitlement.
Yeah, they've changed the names a little bit, and I don't have the Ontario ones in front of me, I'm sorry, but in BC, if you're a single individual without a disability,
mm-hmm.
you're looking at $610 a month.
That's more than here.
If you are with a disability, you're looking at around $900 a month.
That's a little less than here.
And if you, and then they have this category called PPMB, persons with persistent multiple barriers to employment, where you're only about $50 a month above the basic rate.
Okay.
But you're excused from some of the more, you know, some of the work search obligations.
Oh, so persons with disabilities are not automatically excused, only a special
class of them. They are too. But the other one is sort of this in-between category that excuses you from those all those work obligations but doesn't get you much more money.
Oh, $50 more than the welfare rate, you mean?
Yeah.
Ouch, okay. All right. Well, how would you characterize the cost of living? Is it as costly out of the city for reasons of supply and communication as it is in the city?
Well, the Lower Mainland broadly, which is where half the population is in BC, is a very expensive place to live, particularly with respect to housing, and one of the most expensive places in the country, for sure. I mean, Toronto may be in the same ballpark, but other than that, it's the most expensive place to live.
Right. And out of the Lower Mainland, where you have...
It varies, but the vacancy rates in many places are tight, and so those, I mean... For a single person, the shelter allowance on welfare is $375 a month, and it's very hard to find housing anywhere in the province at that.
Yeah. The shelter allowance here is, I don't know, on welfare. The shelter allowance here on disability benefits is around $450 or something, but that includes hydro, insurance, rent, water, if you're billed water.
Right, yeah, that would be too. The same here.
Yeah, but on welfare, I don't know that they can break out a shelter allowance, or if they even do, because the welfare rate is just so close to the cost of shelter alone out here.
Yeah, I can't speak to how it's structured there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, they get about $550 now a month, and it's very hard to find an apartment at $400.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. That would be the same here.
And in Toronto, of course, it's impossible.
That would be the same here.
And now a break from our interview, and a break from our usual musical format that I'll tell you more about later on. This is guitarist Dave Clark, Helen Shizgo, and baritone Todd Gore. Steel Rail, with a tune written by Dave's partner, Lucinda Choden. Traveling On.
Train whistle blowing, train whistle blowing. Whistle blows, my heart says go, I'll be traveling on. Hard rains are falling, hard rains are falling. Then the rain here again, I'll be traveling on. Way back in the springtime, thought that I might stay. Now that old blue northern blows me on my way. I'll be traveling on. Coming, cold winds are coming. Winter snow won't chill my bones. I'll be traveling on. Southlands are calling, Southlands are calling. Wanna find sweet sunshine? I'll be traveling on. Way back in springtime, thought that I might stay. Now that old blue northern blows me on my way. I'll be traveling on. Southlands are calling, Southlands calling. wanna find sweet sunshine, I'll be traveling on. Wanna find peace of mind, I'll be traveling on.
You've been listening to Seth Klein, the BC Director for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, talk about their study following the life of people on fixed incomes at well below poverty level for over 2 years in British Columbia.
And when you talk about trying to make ends meet, the other really important finding out of our study, and I'm sure it too would be true in Ontario, is the degree to which rates at these levels force people to make terrible choices.
Don't they?
Including, in the case of women, either staying in or returning to abusive relationships or to prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
And even in our small sample of 62 people, it came up in very disturbing numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There were 1/5 of all of the women in our study reported engaging in prostitution. And in half of those cases, you could point to specific welfare rules that were part of that choice.
Yeah.
Of those women who were in an intimate relationship, 1/3 of them reported being in that relationship for financial reasons,
mm-hmm.
and almost all of them experienced abuse at the hands of their partner.
Really?
So, that's what we were trying to do with the study, is just to say, these are the realities of what it means to be living on welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And when you stand back and look at it, you realize not only is it too hard to make ends meet for people and is it not helping them,
mm-hmm.
but we all pay.
Mm-hmm.
We're paying for this in increased health costs, in criminal justice costs, in the costs borne by innumerable social agencies and charities.
Mm-hmm.
We pay for it over and over again in different ways. There's a false economy to having a system that is as parsimonious and as rigid as it is.
Yeah, if you're actually compromising people's health and they're dying sooner, from a cash flow point of view, you're even cheating yourself in that all these costs are coming due sooner than they otherwise would. People are sicker sooner. People are dying sooner. People can't be independent sooner.
Well, let me give you a concrete example out of the study, which is, 50% of them reported going to the emergency room in the previous 6 months.
Right.
Well, every time they go to an emergency room, and if they're homeless, much more so.
Mm-hmm.
And every time they go to an emergency room, they cost the health system in one night what they would get on welfare for a month.
Right. Yeah. Do they have problems with the numbers of doctors in BC, as they do here?
Yeah. But, you started this interview by talking about measuring poverty and where Ontario seems to be going. And one of the things that I think is worth, that we highlight as an important shift that needs to happen in BC, and where I would say Ontario is a little ahead of us.
Oh, yeah.
We've been intrigued by where Newfoundland's been going with this anti-poverty strategy that they have. And
I think Ontario is too.
Well, and Ontario is now moving there. At least McGuinty had to promise one in the course of last year's election. And,
mm-hmm.
and it remains to be seen what kind of meat it has to it.
Yes.
But the Newfoundland one, my sense is that social justice people in Newfoundland say that what they have matters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become a useful way for them to leverage important changes and policy changes. Newfoundland has higher welfare rates than BC does,
even though
the cost of living is much less.
Mm-hmm.
They've indexed welfare rates.
Oh.
So every year, welfare rates will keep up with the cost of living instead of eroding year after year after year.
Right.
But mostly the difference is that here in BC, and, certainly historically, in Ontario, we measure success by caseload reduction.
Yeah.
And that's the wrong measure of success.
Isn't it? Because people don't always leave voluntarily.
Well, and even if they do, they're not necessarily leaving poverty. I mean, that's an important point out of our study. So even when you look at the end of the 2 years of our study, mm-hmm. the people who remained on social assistance are still very poor.
Mm-hmm.
The people who were kicked off social assistance were not employed, living on virtually no income, and were deeply poor.
Mm-hmm.
But even of the 12 people who left welfare voluntarily, most of them were still poor.
Mm-hmm.
They saw a significant increase in their income, but even so, because welfare rates are so low to begin with, all but four of them were still below the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we have a government that trumpets its success by welfare caseload reduction, when if instead our measure of success was poverty reduction, this wouldn't look so, there wouldn't be that much laudable going on here.
I see four press release policy recommendations. It says among the policy recommendations are the following, and they speak about increasing and indexing rates. They speak about categorizing appropriately and in a reasonable length of time. They speak about people being cut off arbitrarily and appropriately with unacceptable hardship and harm. And they talk about meaningful supports. It's my impression in Ontario that the people who do the worst on fixed incomes are, unfortunately, single mothers. Do you have that same phenomenon in BC?
Well, single mothers are about a third of the caseload
mm-hmm.
on social assistance, and they represent a significant share of people, of families below the poverty line.
How do their benefits compare with, say, single people or
a single mother on social assistance would be getting around $1,000 a month.
And if she didn't have a child?
Then, as a single person, you're back at the $610.
Oh, I see. So she gets significantly more.
Yeah. So there, but the costs are also more.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, when I mentioned that four people in our study had gotten above the poverty line,
mm-hmm.
none of the single mothers had,
mm-hmm.
which speaks to the fact that even if you're in the workforce,
mm-hmm.
the wages are low, you have higher expenses with the child,
mm-hmm.
you have the whole struggle around accessible child care, so you may not be able to get as many hours,
mm-hmm.
and so you remain below the poverty line.
One of the things that comes to my mind when I think of...
But I should just say, most single parents who are poor mm-hmm. are not on welfare. They're in the labor market.
I see. So they've taken underpaid work?
But they're still poor, yeah.
Yeah. Or they've had to work under hours because of their child care responsibilities.
Right.
Yeah. They're one of the most important things, it seems to me, and this is informal because I haven't done a study, is that the system seems punitive in discouraging the acquisition of assets. I know, for instance, a church here that contributes to the savings of people who are willing to take part in its employment program, and they will match them 2-to-1 or even 3-to-1, but they're discussing with welfare, can welfare view this as assets rather than as income? Because it's meant to be saved, and there is a commitment to saving it and a commitment to directing it to a specific goal within a specific time frame. And they're getting a lot of flack back from welfare.
That's happening all across the country.
Yeah, poor people acquiring assets just isn't a hard sell.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, in most provinces, I think in all provinces, there are asset rules around eligibility for welfare. I mean, every province has its own threshold.
Yeah, it makes sense, but they seem punitively low, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
extremely low.
And they seem low enough to deprive people of the resilience to get off of welfare,
yeah.
The resilience to take a risk or wait a month for a paycheck or whatever's required.
It is very ironic, and it makes them more susceptible to falling back into poverty or onto social assistance in the future.
Yeah. So there does seem to be at least some informal dialogue between Ontario and BC. You don't study Ontario's system, right? But I would imagine that many of these, from the look of them, many of these recommendations are as applicable in Ontario as they are in BC. What do you hope for to see implementation in BC? Is there any progress in that direction?
Well, I mean, we work in coalition with many other groups who we hope take work like this, and it just helps build the pressure to increase welfare rates. I mean, I should say a year ago there was an increase in welfare rates in British Columbia for the first time in about 10 years. And that happened because we and others were putting the pressure on, and municipal governments were starting to put pressure on, and it finally created a situation where they had to move. I mean, I think that's partly how this happens. I think some of the recommendations that we have that are more at the administrative level around how quickly people get categorized appropriately, or the rules by which people get kicked off, I think in engaging with the government, ourselves and others, there's room for some movement there. We shall see.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be as direct a dollar cost to those recommendations, and there does seem to be a benefit. Last question, I guess. You mentioned in Newfoundland that they had rates significantly above BC's and Ontario's. Were they raised all at once? Was there a backlash, or was, in fact, there a large wellspring of public approval when rates went up?
All I can tell you is, and this is partly why we're interested in it, Danny Williams is pretty well the most popular politician in the country.
Okay.
I mean, he has approval ratings that any other politician in the country right now would die for. And what's interesting about where he's gone with his anti-poverty strategy is he has said, you know, this isn't just a goal for the ministry responsible for welfare.
Yeah.
It is an overarching goal of government.
He said,
here are concrete targets and timelines, and this is how I want to be accountable. This is how I want you to hold my government responsible. And, you know, that's pretty good.
Did they give the people on fixed incomes one big raise?
I don't... Well, Newfoundland always had somewhat larger increases. There was a jump a couple of years ago, as I recall.
Right.
I can't remember how it was structured from category to category. And then they announced this indexation at the same time.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Was there anything that you would like to say about your study and its purpose, its results, and its future?
Well, no. Just invite people to go to the CCPA webpage at policyalternatives.ca and have a look at it.
I think I'll have a closer look at it after this interview myself. Seth, I really appreciate your time late in your day to talk to us about this.
No problem.
You've been listening to Seth Klein, the BC Director for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, talk about their study following the life of people on fixed incomes at well below poverty level for over 2 years in British Columbia. If you're a regular listener, you'll know we've changed the music format of this show because the story is one we've told so many times. Why don't they hear it? With the story in a nutshell, here is Annie DeFranco. It's called Coming Up.
Sits in his 37th floor suite and swivels to gaze down at the city he made me in. He allows me to stand and solicit graffiti until he needs the land I stand on. And I, in my darkened threshold, am pawing through my pockets the receipts, the bus schedules, urgent napkin poems, and matchbook phone numbers, all of which laundering has rendered pulpy and strange loose change. And a key asks me, go ahead. Ask me if I care. I got the answer here. I wrote it down somewhere. I just gotta find it. Mm-hmm. And somebody in their spray paint got too close. Somebody came on too heavy. Now look at me, mad ugly by the drooling letters. I was better off alone, ain't that the way it is? They don't know the first thing, but you don't know that till they take the first swing. My fingers are red and swollen from the cold. I'm getting bold in my old age. So go ahead, try the door. It doesn't matter anymore. No, the weak-hearted or strong-willed, we're being kept alive until we're killed. He's up there. The ice is clinking in his glass. He sends us little pieces of paper. I don't ask. I just empty my pockets and wait. It's not fate. It's just circumstance. I don't fool myself with romance. I just live phone number to phone number, dusting them against my thighs and the mark of my pockets, which whisper history incessantly, asking me, where were you? Caring, bearing weight, but I love this city, this state, this country is too large, and who's ever in charge of there better take the elevator down and put more than change in our cup, or else we are coming up.
And now we have some news. National Post, Saturday, March the 21st. Vancouver's housing habit. A million a day can't fix the downtown east side, by Brian Hutchinson in Vancouver. All that money didn't save Wendy Desjardins. She died there last month inside her subsidized, roach-infested apartment. A 54-year-old drug addict, Miss Desjardins, was found in her bathtub. She'd been there for days, but no one knew until water began dripping into an apartment below. Her death was barely noticed. Ms. Desjardins was warehoused. Her condition worsened, yet she received no assistance. The apartment became even filthier. Eventually, cockroaches invaded. She died on February the 15th. Her sister, Darla Hildebrandt, was informed 2 days later. By then, the body had been removed. It was cremated. There was no funeral. Ms. Hildebrandt tried to recover the one possession that her late sister had held dear, an old Bible filled with handwritten letters, but someone had taken it from the apartment. When I inspected the place a few days later, it was in shambles. Possessions were still scattered everywhere. I found a few items belonging to Ms. Desjardins: crack pipes, 2 bags of clothing, a wet bathrobe lying inside the tub where she had died, and an apartment rental receipt for $800. Her sister can't understand how this could have happened. I spoke on the telephone with Wendy every day, almost to the end, Ms. Hildebrandt says. She'd cry and say there was no one to help her. And I'd say, come on, that's what all the services and stuff down there is for. There must be someone who can help you. But I guess there really wasn't. From the Globe, Kate Allen in Vancouver. A common vehicle break-in turned deadly in downtown Vancouver after police shot and killed a man wielding a box cutter. Vancouver Police Department spokeswoman Jana McGinnis said the incident occurred after a 9/11 call reporting that someone was breaking into a car on Granville Street. Police were given descriptions of 2 suspects. Officers requested backup because they said 1 suspect had a knife. Next thing we know, the guy was shot and killed, said Constable McGinnis. She would not say whether the officers were carrying tasers. She said the man advanced on the officers with a box cutter and did not comply when told to drop it. Police said the 2 officers are female and both have 5 years on the force. Police said they do not know the man's identity except that he was in his 50s. Witnesses said he appeared to be homeless. Police Chief Jim Chu said the investigation into the incident will be led by external agencies. I read another article in another paper that told me that the 2 officers did not have tasers. Ottawa trims funds to fight fetal alcohol disorders, from the Star, Dean Beebe, the Canadian Press. Federal money earmarked to fight the tragedy of fetal alcohol disorders has been quietly chopped back year after year, says a new report. Each year, the initiative received only a portion of the dollars allocated, says an internal evaluation. It is unclear why this cutback has become the norm. Quote, even the funds that are released are done so gradually throughout the year that managers are uncertain about the budget they have to work with until the final quarter of the fiscal year, says the report. Again, the Globe, poverty and economic stimulus. Murray Campbell at the Globe and Mail, the real story about the economy lies with the poor. If you want to hear the real story about the economy, you have to go down the laneway off the busy Toronto street, past the dead raccoon lying on the electrical transformer, and into the old garage that has been helping kids grow up for nearly 4 decades. The men who run Canada's troubled auto companies don't come to the Cabbage Town Youth Center, and neither do their well-paid employees. It's not the sort of place where you would find David Dodge and Stephen Harper debating how long the recession will last. Here the talk is more about the lack of affordable housing, the shrinking job market, and the drudgery of getting on. We need more money, said Chrysantha Sahayaraja, who came from Sri Lanka 8 years ago and is struggling to raise two children and to help her mother on $16,000 a year since her husband lost his job. We are struggling here. It is very expensive, this country. Mrs. Sahayaraja told her story to Premier Dalton McGuinty as part of a staged event in which he maintained that he hasn't forgotten his commitment to thin the ranks of Ontario's poor, despite the downturn in the economy. He is under enormous pressure to live up to the commitment he made 4 months ago to reduce child poverty by 25% within 5 years. Anti-poverty activists have been unnerved lately by their reading of the tea leaves. They note that Finance Minister Dwight Duncan didn't mention the poor in a recent speech about the economic stimulus plans in Thursday's budget, and they fretted when Deb Matthews, the cabinet minister responsible for the poverty file, suggested the recession could affect the government's strategy by noting that, quote, things have changed. The huzzas rained down on the premier from activists who saw his recent increase in child benefit to $1,100 per child annually from the $600 effective this July 1st, rather than in 2011. Activists saw the moves as a good first step and were delighted that there were any steps at all. The pressure on Mr. McGuinty will not dissipate, however, despite a collapse in the economy that has taken Ontario quickly from a budget surplus to a projection of $18 billion in deficits in the next 2 years. Sarah Blackstock of the Income Security Advocacy Centre noted that the rise in the benefit does nothing to help the growing ranks of single jobless people. Activists want reform of a welfare system that requires people to divest themselves of their assets before getting assistance. The Premier agreed, it's a stupid rule. Unwittingly, we have developed a policy that stomps you into the ground, he said, but he quickly added, with admirable honesty, that he hasn't got an answer yet. Don't rush to judge officers who use tasers, RCMP chief. From the Braidwood Inquiry, by Gloria Galloway in the Globe. The commissioner of the RCMP said the angry outcry that followed the tasering of a Polish man who died in the Vancouver airport comes from people who do not understand the pressures faced by his officers. Quote, I do not believe that most Canadians have an appreciation as to how difficult the situations our officers find themselves in are. Quote, Commissioner Elliott said, they don't realize how quickly things happen and they don't realize how quickly, often unfortunately, bad things happen. Commissioner Elliott said he would ask Canadians to reflect for a minute before they jump to conclusions. Even in situations where people make mistakes or don't act appropriately, I think there is a requirement to do a sober, sound examination of the facts or the circumstances, and I think the expression, quote, walk a mile in my shoes, unquote, comes to mind. Editorial in the Star, energy savings help the poor. High-efficiency furnaces and programmable thermostats, better insulation, and greener refrigerators help reduce energy, which benefits us all. But what of low-income Ontarians who live in some of the least energy-efficient homes, yet can't afford to do anything about it? Many are struggling just to keep the lights and heat on. They're in the greatest need of the savings that come from energy efficiencies. As a province struggling with the need for new power generation to keep up with demand, we need everyone to reduce their consumption. We must bear in mind that Ontario's poorest tend to be renters, not homeowners. Many don't even have separate heat controls in their apartments, and an even greater number have utilities included in their rent. Landlords must be part of the equation. That's a role the Ontario Energy Board rightly says the province will have to take on. Sarah Blackstock, again, a founding member of the Low Income Energy Network, which forced the Energy Board to act, is pleased with the announced programs. The Energy Board is finally taking responsibility for affordability as part of its mandate to set energy rates, but there are some stumbling blocks that will have to be worked through in the next few months while the Board with Social Services Agencies comes up with the specific details of its conservation program. Blackstock adds, we still have a long way to go to ensure that all Ontarians have access to green, affordable energy. Finally, though, Ontario is starting down the necessary road. Another editorial from the Star. This one, Tuesday, March the 24th, fix welfare rules that hurt the jobless. To get welfare, it's not enough to have lost your job and run out of employment insurance. If you're one of the 30% of unemployed workers who manage to even qualify, you must be destitute. Premier Dalton McGuinty knows there's a problem. Last Friday, he admitted these rules stomp people in the ground, saying, "I'm not sure that serves anybody's interest." Yet instead of saying he would change this, McGuinty said the government needs to keep looking for answers, even while the province is still shedding jobs. The trouble is that Ontario's outdated welfare rules could well delay an economic recovery and hold back future employment. That's because many of the newly unemployed will be forced to strip themselves of assets before qualifying for welfare, leaving them so demoralized and broke that they'll stay on it even longer. That means taxpayers will wind up paying more, not less, because of these rules. That's a false economy. McGuinty has already committed to reducing child poverty by 25% within 5 years. He followed through last Friday with a commendable $400 million boost to the child benefit. But the focus on children has unfairly excluded singles and couples without children, the paltry sum of $520 per month, or $920 for a single parent with a young child, makes it impossible to live with any decency on welfare. Welfare is supposed to be a safety net that catches people when everything else fails and helps them get back on their feet. Unfortunately, the system we have is a net that traps people and holds them back. The longer we wait to deal with this reality, the more poor Ontarians will suffer and the more it will cost taxpayers in future budgets. And from the States, maybe good news, dispensers of marijuana find relief in policy shift. This from the weekend New York Times. Friday, March the 20th. The air inside the Los Angeles Patients and Caregivers Group was pungent with the aroma of premium hydroponic marijuana, but the proprietor, Don Duncan, said on Thursday that he was breathing a bit easier. A day before, Attorney General Eric H. Holder Jr. had said that the federal authorities would no longer take action against medical marijuana dispensaries if they were in compliance with state and local laws. Mr. Duncan, the dispensary owner, said he was cautiously optimistic about Mr. Holder's statement, but reserved judgment about how much things would change in his business. "I think we're going to see less and less federal interference," he said. "At the same time, there's going to be more and more scrutiny from state and local agencies." And last, Jim Coyle in the Toronto Star. "Resurrections of Harrisites boggles the mind." To read the names of the hacks and schemers resurfacing along with Harris is like an appalling acid flashback to a period of reckless and ruinous excess. Word is that former Premier Mike Harris, in hopes of yanking the party sharply back to the right, is strongly supporting his former Cabinet Minister Tim Hudak in the nascent race to succeed John Tory as Progressive Conservative leader. To revisit some of the highlights, or more properly, lowlights of the Harris era is to be struck by the suspicion that this unholy renaissance of an ideology and its cast of adherents might well keep the Liberal government of Premier Dalton McGuinty in power for perpetuity, irrespective of his dreamy ditherings or the havoc global economic chaos inflicts on Ontario. Harris insisted in the end that he regretted nothing. "If I had to do it all over again, I would have tried to do more and do it more rapidly." No less a right-winger than David Frum has warned that the Gingrichian nostrums of the 90s are passé, that there are things only government can do, and that conservatives must prove that we care enough about government to manage it well. Yet here comes Harris and his horsemen of the apocalypse riding again. The horror. The horror. Now, last week we asked for input on the nature of a new segment of the program. Cutter Baloney has declined to be interviewed from this week forward, believing perhaps that the interviews cannot help his immigration bid. So we have a new section of the show, and we're not going to be able to keep this one up without your input. I'll carry the ball this week, but we want your word, not only about the news, but about the new segment at Dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E at radio.fm, dialogue@radio.fm. Special Olympics bowler challenges Obama. "He bowled a 129, I bowl a 300. Special Olympics bowler Colin McConaughey thinks he could beat President Barack Obama in a game of bowling. Thursday, Barack Obama made a quick joke during an interview on The Tonight Show, revealing his latest bowling score to Jay Leno, 129. It was a moment meant to be charming, with the president mocking himself, but he described his bowling performance as the Special Olympics or something. Said California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, "I know because of conversations I've had with the president about Special Olympics, I know where his heart is." And perhaps if you've been in hospital with a disability, you'll identify with Lauren Bacall. Quote, "I'm trying to be busy. It's not so easy. Everyone thinks I'm dead." That's from U.S. Iraqi veteran Dan DeRosa. A soldier at a traumatic brain injury clinic in Alaska, Sergeant DeRosa is learning new skills to deal with the aftermath of a roadside bomb. Iraq's legacy. Michael Kesterton, The Globe and Mail. I wouldn't say my memory really is getting any better, but my ability to adapt to the fact that my memory's really not getting any better has gotten a lot better. This from U.S.-Iraqi veteran Dan DeRosa, a soldier at a traumatic brain injury clinic in Alaska. Sergeant DeRosa is learning new skills to deal with the aftermath of a roadside bomb. And from the Toronto Star. It's a dauntingly competitive field, but amid many worthy contenders, here's our nomination for top prize in the Master of the Obvious sweepstakes. The world is a very different place than it's been in the past. That trenchant observation was made by Ontario Finance Minister Dwight Duncan above after a speech to a joint Empire and Canadian Club luncheon in Toronto this month. It also explains why the provincial government has already announced it will run up a deficit of $18 billion over the next 2 years, even though it won't deliver its formal budget until Thursday. Meanwhile, if you're the type of person for whom bad news isn't official until you're well-versed in all the details, you can watch the budget announcement live online at 4 p.m. by pointing your browser here, tinyurl.com, ONTBudget, on HTTP, onlinemedicalsupplyblog.wordpress.com. What's wrong with you? How often we disabled hear this line from kids on a daily basis is mind-blowing. Somehow all the kids in the world are born with the same question-asking genes, and they all hit this one right on the dot. But I think it's funny, and I find various ways to answer it. My all-time favorite response to this question is, I didn't eat my vegetables. What is your favorite response to this question? And more on the Special Olympics. This from en.wikisource.org/wiki/disabled. Washington, D.C. The International Special Olympics Committee has begun to investigate charges that athletes used performance-enhancing hugs in their training and directly before competing in key events. These people have no shame, ISOC Chairman Bill Evans said Monday. Right before a big game or race, many of them will take a dose of affection, sometimes from a coach, other times from a family member. Competing players have been known to exchange hugs during the competition itself. Although insiders have long attested to widespread hug use among special athletes, the full scope of the problem was not understood until Carnegie Mellon published a study on hug use in the Clinical Journal of Sport Medicine. According to the study, researchers found double-digit spikes in self-valuation, warm fuzziness, and even smiles following even a single hug. Evans said he, quote, took one look at the numbers, quote, and agreed to an internal investigation and an across-the-board review of hug use policies. Hug users have an unfair advantage over the hug-free as they are pumped up with confidence, Evans said. In competitions relying on endurance, hugs serve to artificially heighten an athlete's stamina. For example, hug users may be as much as 65% more likely to excel at no-contact floor hockey than those who say no to hugs. Put simply, it's unethical. Alpine skiing bronze medalist Lee Young-suk, who has Down syndrome, appeared on a special edition of ABC's Primetime Live Tuesday and admitted to frequent use of performance-enhancing hugs. When my mommy hugs me, it makes me feel like I'm the best and she loves me and I can win, Suk told Diane Sawyer. I'm a winner. The emotions Suk described, euphoria, omnipotence, overall well-being, have been found to last for as little as 5 minutes or as long as several hours, depending upon the number and type of embraces administered. Due to the short burst effect of performance-enhancing hugs, testing for their presence is difficult. Currently, eyewitness sightings are the only reliable indicators of hug use, said ISOC regulator Peter Warner. Unfortunately, hug use can occur anywhere. From the group home to the bleachers, we can't be in every team's van at all times. In the search for hug abusers, regulators have screened hundreds of hours of Special Olympics videotape from Nagano. Hoping to catch huggers in the act, they are also relying on testimony from hug users such as Suk. Lee Young-suk really stood his ground at first, saying he did not want to tattle on his friends, Warner said of the hug user. We couldn't get him to give us any names. Still, as Evans pointed out, hug use does not necessarily translate into better athletic performance. Over time, it may even serve as a hindrance. Ironically, many of the worst special athletes are the ones getting the most hugs, Evans said. Once they get hooked, even if it isn't helping their game, these Olympians continue to crave the affection, accepting it as almost a consolation prize for their effort. Sometimes you see special athletes seeking hugs outside the realm of competition, just for the sake of hugging. This is where we get into really dangerous territory. That's it for Disrespect this week. We hope you'll submit for the new segment. The email again is dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. We need your humor to keep our humor here on the show. Next week, we have a segment called Adventures in a New Wheelchair. We also have an interview with McMaster Professor Peter Grafe on how to evaluate the McGinty budget. And now to take us out, in keeping with the ending of the show, Bill Morrissey, Picnic.
Mama brought a blanket and a picnic basket. She led us kids out on the grass. She brought Coca-Colas and cold fried chicken. If you wanted anything, you just had to ask. The sun was shining on me and my brothers. We couldn't have felt better if we tried. I remember Mama's words as we broke the bread and fed the birds. Everything tastes a little bit better when you eat outside. San Francisco in 82. Me and my bride sat out on the patio. The waiter brought a white wine for the newlyweds who couldn't dream of a better place to go. A gentle breeze blew as she moved close. She kissed me on the lips and I replied. I guess my mama was right when she told me one night everything tastes a little bit better when you eat outside. A summer in Maine in 91, I'd just been laid off, but the neighbors never knew. I cooked them up the swordfish, the steaks and the chickens, just about anything you could barbecue. That was just a week before my wife packed her things and took the kids back to her folks in Telluride. But man, you know those steaks were good that night. Back in 91, everything tastes a little bit better when you eat outside. Well, that's my story. It ain't a long one. Every bum on the street's got one to tell. Now it's just you and me waiting for this restaurant to close. And man, I've come to know this dumpster well. Yeah, it's starting to rain now and you better stay low, 'cause these cops will get you if they catch you on the slide. It's like camping out, but really, there's just no place else to go. Everything tastes a little bit better when you eat outside. You'll find everything tastes a little bit better when you eat outside.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.